May it please the Court. Is our contention that this case is controlled by the decision in the Gene decision?
In what? I'm sorry.
Gene versus the Commissioner. The ultimate holding at the end of the case is, and I quote, Congress intended the EJIA to cover the cost of all phases of successful litigation. The district court thought it could divide this case into phases, and we think it departed from the central holding in Gene in that regard.
Now, even under Gene, if the district court were to conclude that the litigation over fees was justified, it doesn't have to pay you for that, presumably. You're still the prevailing party, et cetera, but they can use their discretion to figure out how much you're owed, correct?
I think maybe there are two questions there. The answer to the first one is no. The central holding of Gene is that if the government's underlying position on the merits was not substantially justified, that's the end of the inquiry.
I think what Judge Schrafer is asking.
What I'm asking is, how do they decide what is a reasonable fee? I'm with you so far. You're entitled to a reasonable fee, but in deciding reasonableness, can't the court then take into account whether or not you prevailed on some of the fee issues and so on and so forth, and adjust the amount of reasonable fee according to how things went at various phases of the litigation?
I think, again, it's two questions, and the answer to the first one is no, but the second one is yes. If you're asking whether the court could award a lower fee because the government's position on the fee litigation was reasonable, I think the answer is no, they could not do that. That's exactly the argument we advanced.
But in that regard, this case does seem somewhat different for many of the reasons that you were talking about in your briefs, which is that the 406B question is essentially, it seems to me, part of the merits of the case. In other words, as you stressed, the ultimate judgment encompasses the benefit decision and the 406B allocation, right?
Yes.
So why isn't it more helpful to look at this case as the substantial justification question as going to the case as a whole, i.e., the benefits decision and the 406B allocation decision, and thereby determining whether that was substantially justified and what reasonable fee was expended on that?
Well, I think the core holding of Gene is that once there wasn't substantial justification for the government's position on the merits, the denial of benefits to Mr. Gisbrecht, we are done analyzing substantial justification.
And what I'm saying is I'm not sure the analogy holds perfectly to the 406B question. That doesn't necessarily determine the result as to – it doesn't support the government's position either. You don't chop the fees off at that point. But and look at the substantial justification separately on the fees issue. But it also doesn't lead to the conclusion that the substantial justification on the fees issue is entirely irrelevant. It may be relevant, although it may not end up mattering because the merits is more important. I'm suggesting some middle ground analysis that's somewhat different than what you said.
It's a plausible position, but I think it's not the position the court took in Gene.
But I share the concern that Judge Prezan's raising that, I mean, Gene didn't involve 406 fees, right?
No.
So, in a sense, I mean, we have to make a choice. We either are going to extend Gene to something it didn't cover, or we're going to limit Gene and make up some new rule which might be favorable to you or the other side relating to 406.
Well, I think those
are... But we can't just say... I mean, I realize you should argue Gene covers it, and your opponent should argue Gene doesn't. But really, we can't just say, oh, well, you know, Gene's got it covered. Why are we here?
But I think that the rationale of Gene reaches this case for a couple of reasons. First, the court's view in Gene was that there should not be multiple determinations of the reasonableness of the government's position. And the court noted that if that were the case, you determine the reasonableness of the position on the merits, then the reasonableness of the position in the litigation, then the reasonableness of the position on litigation for fees, then the reasonableness of their position on litigation for fees for the litigation of the fees. They said once is enough. We're going to stop with the merits. But I think there's a broader reason why Gene should apply here. we believe that the core purpose of Congress in adopting EJIA was to assure that a particular rule for cases in which the government's underlying decision on the merits lacks substantial justification. And the purpose of EJIA was to assure that the individual affected would have access to the courts because their lawyer would be paid for it. Not paid for part of the work. Because if you only pay for part of the work, you won't necessarily going to get a lawyer. You have to basically pay for all the work that then follows in that litigation. Cut back on that, then you affect access. One of the things the court said in Gene, it was not a problem there, but it is clearly a problem here, is that there will be cases in which the amount of expense and time that goes into the fee litigation is substantially greater than the fee itself. And that's why we need fees for fee litigation. Otherwise, the underlying right to fees will be worthless in the case where it would cost more to seek the fees than the fees themselves.
Right, but in that case, in Gene, the money is coming from outside the system, right? And here, the money is not coming from outside the system. We're moving the money around within the system, right? So it's being eaten up, you're right, but it is being eaten up arguably at the expense of the client. Now, that doesn't bother me that much. It still seems, but it doesn't bother me that much when I think about the whole case as being a single case in which the fees and the benefits have to be determined in order to be finished. But the analogy, again, doesn't work very well because the money's not coming from outside the system.
I want to ask the same question in another way because it seems to me that ultimately there's kind of a, not literally a conflict of interest, but there is a conflicting economic interest here that is was not present in Gene because you have sort of a zero-sum game.
Well, let me address that. The government makes a somewhat broader argument. Let me just focus on that for now. But Mr. Gisbrecht's interests are not as narrowly circumscribed as the government suggests. Mr. Gisbrecht was severely disabled. He'd been on Social Security. He was cut off. He got a lawyer, was able to get back on. Now, if the government prevails, we will go to Mr. Gisbrecht with the following account. We say, we've got good news and bad news. The good news is you've got $3,000 more. But the bad news is you may not be able to get a lawyer if they cut you off again, because if the cost of litigating the fees is going to be greater than the fees, a lawyer will look at the case and say it's just not worth the risk. This is one of those cases. This is a case, I mean, on the government's view of what the hours are that would be appropriate here, we disagree about some details. This is a case in which the underlying fees were about 200 hours. The litigation about the issue that was before you earlier totaled, on the government's views of the appropriate fees, $800. There are the net award in this case on the government's view would be $28,000, of which about $9,000 is costs. So the total award is about $19,000 for over $1,000 worth hour 1,000 hours work. That's about $19 an hour. Lawyers won't take a case of 19 hours an hour. So from the point of view of Mr. Gisbrecht, he may have been out $3,000, but the viability of this system, one in which a lawyer can take a case reasonably confident that they'll get paid enough to make a living,
that argument is very well put and goes to the issues about whether they're prevailing parties and so on. It doesn't necessarily deal directly with the question of whether we can take Gene as written, ignore the fact that the money is being moved around within the system. In other words, it responds to many of the government's arguments, but it doesn't necessarily respond to the exact analogy to Gene.
It's a little bit different. I guess our view is the difference doesn't affect the outcome. Mm-hmm. The government arguments against applying Gene here are considerably more expansive than the more limited question that you've raised. And they really go to the vitality of Gene in Social Security and indeed in other cases. For example, the government's view is that EJIA does not apply unless the client benefits from the fee award. Well, most of the time, clients don't benefit from fee awards. Remember, the holding of Gene is under EJIA, you get fees for fee litigation. government's view is, oh, yes, Gene means that unless the client didn't benefit from the fee award. Well, clients almost never benefit from the fee award.
At least we don't know in June. We don't know what the deal was in June. We don't know whether the client was going to have to pay if there was no EJIA award or didn't.
Well, actually, in June, the lawyer was the Haitian Immigrant Resource Center.
Well, we may not. We can be fairly confident that
they were not going
to. But we can be fairly confident, too, that even if there was a deal to pay them, it still would have come out the same way. Didn't matter.
Right, but what I'm suggesting is, as a practical matter, there's a substantial body of EJIA cases in which the client does not benefit from the fee award.
Because of the terms of the fee agreement? Is that why, or for some other reason?
The client could
have a fee agreement that says, I'm going to give my lawyer X percent of any recovery, plus if there's a recovery of fees, the lawyer gets it all,
It sometimes could be the contract, but sometimes it happens by operation of law. And that's true in a lot of Title II Social Security cases, which are a very substantial portion of all EJIA cases, which is why this issue is so important. In many Social Security cases, the same lawyer represents the claimant in the administrative process and in court. And the fee agreements typically are for 25%. An EJIA award for the court work is only a set off against a 25% award or a fee award against the client in court. But if the lawyer is already getting a 25% or whatever, we understand that it's a little more complicated than that, because of the administrative representation, then there's no separate award simply for the work in the court, and there's no set off. All the EJIA money goes to the lawyer. In any case, or most cases, in which the claimant was represented by the same lawyer in the administrative process and in the judicial proceeding, all the EJIA money goes to the lawyer by operation of law. And on the government's views, you couldn't get fees for fee litigation, and Gene would not apply. And a large portion of actual cases under EJIA, Gene would become inapplicable.
Tell the government they're wrong about that, that Gene applies to that. That still doesn't answer whether it applies in this 406 context, right?
Yes, you could certainly frame a narrower rule. Our view is that the Gene applies to 406B claims, at least in general, despite that. Partially because the rationale I gave you for what we think the purpose of EJIA is, but also because of the text of the statute. If you were to hold, it seems to me you can't read the statute to hold that EJIA fees are never available for disputes under 406B. And if that's right, it would apply even if the government's position had no substantial justification. The statute, EJIA itself, has a number of expressed statutory exceptions. EJIA does not apply to disputes sounding in tort. It does not apply expressly to certain disputes under the Internal Revenue Code.
Their argument, I gather, isn't that it doesn't apply in the abstract. It doesn't apply, they're arguing, because there are various factors that are necessary to establish EJIA fees that don't have to apply here, is their argument.
Yes, but our contention is this. When Congress wanted to remove a kind of claim from EJIA, it did so expressly. It did so expressly as to tort, it did so expressly as to certain internal revenue cases, and then it began EJIA with, except as expressly provided by statute. And Congress was well aware about 406B claims.
This is where I'm having a problem, which is more of a problem about how we analyze this than how it comes out. Because as you talk, it starts coming back at me again, which is that you're asking for EJIA fees on the question of how the money is distributed within the Social Security system, right? And therefore, to say that the statute resolves it is right because it's part of the merits of the case. It's really part of what we have to decide, always, to decide a benefits case of this kind. Because there's about always going to be a lawyer, and before you can get a judgment, you always have to do something with the fees, and there has to be a determination as to it. So you can't get in and out of court without deciding it. That is, for me, an easier way to look at this than to look at it as a fees-on-fees question. It's really not a fees-on-fees question. It's really a question of a fee for the merits of the case.
Your Honor, on that rationale, as I understand it, we'd prevail and we would be happy. We're not wedded to our theory, only to the result.
But I guess it would be helpful to me not to know why you came in the other way and why it's preferable in some way, because it's not. To me, I have a hard time understanding that rationale.
Well, I think the best answer is probably was we weren't as ingenious and creative as you were in your approach to this. I think that rationale works perfectly well. If you treat that as part of the merits, then we prevail there. And
you might want to save the rest of your time.
Yes,
let me raise a question, if I may, though. Just to put this in perspective, I apologize. I probably should know this from the briefs, but give me the order of magnitude of three things. The fees on the underlying initial resolution of the claimant's dispute, the fees on the appeal of that, on the direct appeal of that had to do with whether the claimant wins or loses on appeal, and third, the fees on the 406B dispute.
I'm not sure there are three numbers here. I guess there are. Right. Originally, the district court, before the appeal that you heard, awarded approximately $15,000 in fees. That was using the lodestar method. Then, after we prevailed, the Supreme Court and the court and the district court looked at this again under the new method sanctioned by the Supreme Court. The court raised that to $28,000. The fee claim with regard to the 406B dispute is for approximately $190,000, of which $110,000 isn't in dispute as to amount. That is, that's
sui generis, because this case happened to go to the Supreme Court, and it's
right.
More useful if we would think about what would happen tomorrow in the next case.
Yeah, I think the order of magnitude of everything is probably about 10% of it. That is, typical claims are $3,000 to $5,000for fees, and an appeal would obviously not be would be, if you had to litigate over a 406B claim, it would be more substantially more than $3,000 or $4,000, but it wouldn't be $100,000 or $200,000. It might be $30,000. I think that's the order of magnitude. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you a question that relates to the colloquy that was just had. Opposing counsel is happy to win on any theory because they want the fees. Judge Berzon is saying, as a practical matter, this case isn't going to replicate itself more than once every 25 years, because that's about how often the Supreme Court seems to take a Social Security fee case. Does the government have much theoretical interest in this case? And if not, why isn't this a good candidate for mediation?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the theoretical interest that the government has in this is in the same sort of theoretical interest that it had in other cases in which, in the context of an overall case, that there are portions of the case that, in fact, are not comparable to the way in which Gene is set up. And so, I mean, it is, I'm not saying that in no way could something like this be beyond mediation, but I do think that the issue here, I mean, and in some ways the fact is that this case is probably not going to be replicated, and our position in this case is going to be different only because the fee litigation on the 406B issue here was such an extreme, took a big chunk of time. And
in fact, the district court had this very strange reaction, which is that you could get they could get the fees for the district court, but not the appeal.
Absolutely.
Which only reflects that it seems to be fairly routine that, in fact, each of fees are available for 406B in the usual case, which is you decide in the district court, and that's the end of it. Nobody seemed to have a problem with that.
That's true. The 406B litigation in this case is unlike the typical 406B litigation, which is about non-payment of money or delays in payment. And there's no suggestion in that case on the government's part that those fees would not be compensable under the sort of Gene theory.
Well, why not? And how do you distinguish them? What's the difference?
Because as this court in Ginsburg itself, and as the Supreme Court analyze this case. What happened at the point which these attorneys started to fight over how the 406B fee was calculated? There was a shift in the sort of in.
Well, that would be true if it was a non-payment dispute or anything else.
Not in the same way, Your Honor. Here, what the Supreme Court said was that these attorneys all of a sudden became the real parties in interest. It was no longer about their clients. In fact, the alignment of interest was against their clients because their clients, as the Supreme Court said, were going to get less money out of their past.
But that's not necessarily true. The clients enter into an agreement to pay them 25% and to help them get the fees. And as your opponent points out, they have this particular client has long-term interest in being able to get lawyers, and the class of clients has a long-term interest in being able to get lawyers, and the government perhaps has a long-term interest in their not being able to get lawyers, so they can pay out less benefits. So who has what interest here is far from clear.
Your Honor, there's certainly the Congress has set up a system whereby it was going to attract enough competent lawyers to handle Social Security benefits cases, and it set it up in a way that it was going to allow the commissioner to take and keep up to 25% out of their past due benefits to set that scheme up. Nonetheless, the Supreme Court said when it came to this particular case that the interests now were different, that the interests here were the real parties in interest had switched to the attorneys.
How would that be different than in each case like Gene if we knew that the agreement there, as it probably almost surely was that any money was going to the lawyers?
The interest there is that the what the lawyers are litigating on behalf of in the ordinary case and in Gene is an interest that is not divided against their clients. Is an interest
but
is getting
it's an interest of the lawyer. The divided part is nothing you've now added, but it's the lawyer's interest, right? Who's going to get the money in a Gene case?
In the Gene case, I mean that's another thing that is true is that the it is universally understood that in EJIA cases, the attorney's fees belong to the client. Now,
but who's really going to get the money? Who's the real party in interest?
No, that's an important distinction because although, in fact, most of the fees are going to go over to the attorney, it is true, but there can be a dispute, and in those circumstances, the dispute between the attorney and his client over the payment of fees is a dispute between those two parties, and it's much more analogous to a dispute that was at issue in this Gisbrecht case. And that's because when the Supreme Court also said that the government's position in this case was much more like a trustee for the individual claimant.
It said this in a footnote, and it was of no consequence to anything in the case. And to hang too much on it doesn't seem worth a lot.
I'm not sure that that's appropriate, because whenever you have a shift in the way, if you have a dispute between an attorney and a client, that all of a sudden is different from the underlying merits of the position that the party, that the lawyers are taking on behalf of the party. Whenever we're talking about how much money that the lawyers are owed, that means that there is a shift in the direction of their interest, and whether if the lawyers are going to get more money at the end of the day out of
it. So let's go back to my earlier questions. Is it not the case that there cannot be a judgment in a Social Security case of this kind, that the judgment incorporates the question of, A, what benefits are going to be paid, and, B, what are the 406B fees so that and how that money is shifted around before there's a judgment? Is that right?
Yes, as I understand.
Right. So why are we even looking at this as a fees question? Is it just a merits question, i.e., what are the benefits to be paid, and then what's the distribution of them?
I'm not sure that I understand why this is really just a question of the merits, the underlying merits. The reason why this is different is the same is that. While this issue is in
you're trying to set this up as a separate, you're trying to separate out and saying something has shifted, and now we have a different proceeding in essence, which we should look at separately.
Correct.
And I'm saying, how can that be when you can't even get a judgment in one of these actions without making this decision?
Your Honor, It seems to me that this court has seen in other circumstances, like Love versus Riley, that even, you know, that there are portions of the litigation that end up with a single final judgment in which the dispute that's going on is not the dispute over the judgment.
Judge Graber began, this may all be a reason why in determining the reasonableness of the fees, you might look at the substantial justification with regard to the fee issue and say, well, maybe it's... They didn't win as much as they wanted on the fee issue in this instance. They did. And you might do something with the fees on that. But it doesn't seem to go to whether they are a prevailing party or whether they did incur the fees and the various arguments they've made.
But, Your Honor, when the analysis in Jean, which would be on the question of substantial justification and on prevailing party, that's what gets carried over and which is not that why there's a single... inquiry into those things, and it doesn't change over the various phases of litigation. That's where we're talking about is the government's conduct toward the claimant. When that isn't true anymore in a particular in any phase of the litigation, it seems to me that to rely on the original prevailing party determination, to rely on the original substantial justification.
But the question is, when is the original? Judge Berzon's point is there is no original determination of who is prevailing until both the benefits and the distribution of those benefits have been determined. That is one single lump. And you look at that whole lump to decide who was prevailing and what justification there was or was not.
Except theoretically, the fee that is paid to the attorney under 406B comes after the determination of what the past due benefits are, so that you have actually a determination of the past due benefits. At that point, you know that the claimant has prevailed, and there's a determination afterwards as to...
And by definition, the claimant's lawyer has also prevailed.
I'm not sure that I would see a...
To some extent. How could the claimant, who is represented by a lawyer, prevail, and yet the claimant's lawyer, who got those benefits, not prevail to some extent? I mean, you can fight over how much, but how can they have not prevailed?
They have prevailed, Your Honor, but... To the extent that they get their fees out of the past due benefits judgment. But on the question now as to whether they are supposed to be paid.
If I enter into an agreement with you, it's to my benefit, this is sort of just plain old market theory, it's to my benefit to agree to pay you X, and the government comes along and says, I'm sorry, you agreed to pay him X, but we're not going to let you pay him X. And then we have a whole lot of litigation, and the court decides, okay, you can't pay him X. Why haven't I prevailed?
Well, it's unusual that in that circumstance, the government says you can't pay him X.
But that's what happened here. It's exactly what happened
here. And we're saying that you can't pay him X because the law that we're operating under, which is established by the court...
Well, I understand, but I made a deal to pay him X. I want to pay him X. So why haven't I prevailed if the ultimate decision is I can pay him X?
Why
haven't I, the plaintiff, prevailed?
Because
when I agree to pay somebody a certain amount of money, and you, the government, is interposing the law to say I can't do it.
Because that is not the basis of the litigation on which the party, in terms of getting each of these from the United States, has prevailed. The claimant does not prevail in the litigation on being able to pay the claimant's attorney a certain part of the thing, a certain portion of the fee. The claimant prevails against the United States, and that's why the EJIA is triggered on the merits of the claim. Now, Jean says that as a that included.
But you're choosing to chop it up that way. I'm saying, where is that choice coming from?
I'm saying that we're talking about why is the government paying the EJIA fee. The EJIA fee is being paid because the government's position in the underlying case and in the litigation was not substantially justified. What is the conduct of the government that causes that? When we're talking about a dispute between...
Resisting the client through the client's lawyer. So resisting them both.
But as I understand it, the substantial unjustified conduct that gives rise to the fee claim under the statute and under Jean's is conduct towards the claimant, which was not justified.
Correct.
And so the fees are awarded, so the claimant will be whole. And then the fees are awarded on appeal because it's part and parcel of the same deal. And I am troubled. I don't know the final answer here, but I'm troubled by the idea that once you get into litigation about how the pie is divided up, we're dealing with something a little bit different, that it's not covered quite by genes. And, like, I don't know whether there should be a separate, substantially unjustified determination that would have to be made about that.
Well, our position simply is that it's fine to go through the merits phase of the case, the underlying agency position, the determination of the merits and fees for fees. That's certainly talking about government conduct toward the claimant, which is the basis for the use of fee determination. And we're talking about now a dispute that arises where the government is, in fact, has been called by the Supreme Court, the client's, essentially trustee for the client's position, because in that circumstance, the attorneys, which becomes the real party in interest, which the Supreme Court and this Court held.
That has to be a metaphor, doesn't it?
It's not. Your Honor, I beg to differ. I don't think it's a metaphor. There is a real party in interest analysis is an analysis which is which goes on repeatedly in fee cases. Part of the reason why we're talking about that is whether the real party in interest really goes to who is incurring the fee here for purposes of being compensated. It can't be that these claimants are incurring fees with regard to their lawyers arguing in court for their getting less of the pot. That's why the real party in interest analysis is more than just.
Before, I'm not sure why that's so ridiculous.
Why it's. All I'm answering is that it's not simply a metaphor. It really is important to determine who is incurring the fees in this particular portion of the litigation. This court has held the other things is that the lawyers here essentially are arguing that they are entitled to the fees in their own right and in their own names. They are not named plaintiffs. This court has also determined that even though real parties in interest, for example, in the Southwest Marine case, the real party in interest in that case was the subcontractor could not be a named plaintiff.
Which fees are they claiming they're entitled to in their own name? I assume the EJA fees are just like any other EJA fees. They are fees in the name of the client that are distributed, however it's they may be distributed. Well, is that any different than Gene?
No. They are arguing, and they've argued in their own briefs, that they are entitled by their own right to get EJA fees in the same way that they're entitled to get, that they have a right to the EJA fees in their own name.
Now, we could fix that by saying it's not in your name, it's in the client's name, but why does that matter?
Well, it seems awfully unusual, Your Honor, to have the client recovering attorney's fees against the United States when the entire conflict over which they are now receiving fees is not with regard to the United States, but with regard to their own counsel.
As I read the statute, the EJA fees cannot be awarded except to the prevailing party, which I take to be a litigant party.
That's true, Your Honor.
Rather than who ultimately gets the money. So it would seem that at least the theoretical aspect of it has to be the same, that it's always awarded in the name of the litigant.
That it's always in the name of the party that has prevailed. It seems unusual, Your Honor, that part of the way in which the underlying claimants here have prevailed is by having more of their recovery from the government under the
Social Security. Actually, if they get the fees, they will get more money, is that right? The clients will.
If they get the fees for this,
yeah, well, the clients end up getting more money then because there'll be a reshift of a distribution under the.
In the ordinary course of affairs, yes, they would be able to offset the lower amounts against.
So they really, it's not truly have no interest. They do have an interest. They will get more money this way. Clients.
The client will get more money from their
because of the provision about the lesser about the offset of the lesser amount. Now the EJA fee won't be lesser amount; it'll be the higher amount.
Your Honor, the Supreme Court said that they were going to, that the point is, I assume that that would be true if you viewed this as the as an undifferentiated whole. And that's a possibility.
I have a question for
all of
them. Go ahead.
They have benefits. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt your response to Judge Berzon. When you're done, if you're done with it, I have a question about footnote 6.
Yes, I prepared.
Okay, footnote 6. This is the one where the Supreme Court says the real parties in interest are their attorneys. And we've had some colloquy here about whether that's, you know, loose talk or does that mean something. We do have circuit law that says we're supposed to treat footnotes as precedential in the same way as we treat the text of an opinion, whether it's a Supreme Court footnote or our footnote. And that's problematical because sometimes footnotes don't get the same attention that, you know, the text does, but that seems to be the law. Of course, whether it's in the text or a footnote, if it's a dictum or kind of an aside, we don't have to follow it. So here when the Supreme Court uses a term about the real parties in interest being the attorneys, which is kind of a term of art normally in the law, is that a holding that's the law of the case, or is that just kind of talk that we can that we should view as a dictum because it wasn't litigated? I see they're citing Hopkins v. Cohen, which I haven't read. I don't know if that sheds any light on this real party in interest question.
Footnote 1 in this Court's Ginsburg decision, which obviously that portion was certainly not overturned, makes the same observation that the attorneys are the real parties in interest. I also don't know of any circuit law, certainly outside of the circuit, in which the courts say that that the courts are free to ignore which Supreme Court statements, even dicta that the Supreme Court states that courts of appeals are free to ignore them.
If we say that that's a kind of something we have to follow, and we have to view the lawyers in this particular litigation that went up to the Supreme Court as a real party in interest, how does that then square with the statutory language in the EJA?
I think it makes it difficult to follow the statutory language in the EJA because they are not, if they are the real parties in interest, the only way that they are entitled to get attorney's fees under the EJA is if they are named, or if they themselves are plaintiffs. They are not plaintiffs in this litigation. They have to say whether the claimants on whose, that they're relying on have incurred fees on their behalf. So they have not, they have not shown that they have satisfied the eligibility requirements for purposes of getting fees under their own right. And if this is in fact indeed because of this, a separate segment of the litigation the same way that there was in Love versus Riley, then the government's position certainly was substantially justified in following this circuit's precedent on the determination on the use of a lodestar amount as opposed to a penalty.
In this footnote 6 of the Supreme Court's Gisbrecht case where they make this real parties in interest statement, they're citing a Supreme Court case, Hopkins v. Cohen, and they cite, and I haven't looked at this particular page yet of that. I mean, does that address real party in interest, do you know?
I don't know.
Citing to?
I don't know for a fact. I think what it says is how, it's more about how, sort of, I really don't know.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. And I believe you have a short amount of rebuttal still remaining.
I'll try to use it unless you've had a long day. First of all, let me answer a question asked by Judge Berzon about the form of the request for fees in this case. It's at page 78 of the FATR record excerpts. And it is not a request from the lawyers. It is, as it should have been, a request from the client. It says the plaintiff, the prevailing party, hereby applies. So this was in form the right kind of motion. Let me respond to a question.
How do you square the Supreme Court's real party and interest characterization in that footnote 6 with the EAJA requirement for fees that you be, how do you square it with the EAJA?
The description of the economic interest here is typical of EJA cases. As I think I remember the court pointed out, the court could not possibly have meant to say that where the person who's going to get the EJA money is the lawyer, EJA doesn't apply and there can't be an award of fees. That's most EJA cases. They can't have meant to say that. I mean, it's a loose characterization of who cares about it.
It's any Social Security case in which the EJA fees are more than 25% of the benefits, right?
Sorry, saying
it's any Social Security case in which the EJA fees would be more than 25% of the benefits.
Well, it would apply in any EJA case in which the named plaintiff wasn't going to keep some of the money or benefit from it through an offset. That's most EJA cases.
By law or by their fee agreement.
By law or by the fee agreement, right. It would largely eviscerate the statute. We don't think the court meant to do that in a footnote. You can take footnote seriously, but you can't find revolutionary scene change in the law in a turn of phrase like that. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case just argued is submitted. Again, we appreciate some very interesting and well presented arguments by both counsel. And we will be adjourned for this session.
But all of this is very good work because it's going to be a spread of 2 years from now.